Greetings, everyone. This is a Sound Health Options Show with Richard Talk To Me Guy and Sherry Edwards. Good morning, Sherry.
Good morning, Richard. I was just noticing how much I love your voice. It's good to have you back.
Thank you.
I'm hoping that when we do our announcements that you will catch us up on your croupy crud and being in the fires and what we're doing about it.
Yes,
but we have a couple of things to tell the about our guest today, a distinguished author, inventor, musician, innovator, and one of the things I love about reading his material is that he brings in a lot of diverse ideas and makes new concepts. That's my definition of someone who wants to make a difference. And so I'm very happy that John David Mann is going to be with us. And we'll be talking to him in just a few minutes about all the ways and new directions that he wants to help the planet right after we do a few announcements. We are being brought to you by the Institute of Bioacoustic Biology and Sound Health. And in honor of Richard, we are doing a special project. Well, last week and this week, Richard, in all those fires, burning and devastation, and didn't know what we could do to help. But they started spraying that pink fire retardant on everything. So just like we did it for 9/11 and a lot of other catastrophes, we decoded all of that. And we've put it up on our website, on our portal, actually, our workstation. So all of our audience people can go to Sound Health Portal, like a window on a ship, portal.com. Any platform will work. Our stuff used to not work on Mac, but it does now. So services, and I think it's like breathing beauty or something like that. We couldn't put anything like anti-fire retardant up there. So good breathing, I think it has the word breathing in it. And you can give a sample of your voice and it will tell you whether or not you've been poisoned by these fire retardants. And then there is a link to a chart that will tell you what nutrients that will help, I don't know, antidote it. Richard helped us with one other project. You want to talk about what you did with the Fukushima radiation so they can sort of understand where we're trying to go?
Right when Fukushima happened, within about 5 days, Sherry had written some software to check vocal prints for newbies. A vocal print is a simple recording of your voice, a wave file of your voice that Sherry has software that you can run through for a variety of things, numerous things, maybe up to, I think, 50 software packages now. And this one was for radiation monitoring. And so I would take a vocal print every morning. And early on, she had come up with a chart. And on the chart, it would show, let's say, I can't remember it. I want to say cesium, but that's not quite right. Something like that. A particular kind of, or strontium radiation. And you would run, she would run my voice through the vocal software and give me feedback on it, and I would be able to see that I had elevated levels of strontium showing up in my vocal print from, because I live on the coast of, well, within 30 miles of the coast of California, northern part of the coast, north of San Francisco. And I would see something was elevated, and she had designed a chart that had the particular substances in it, and at the far right of the chart were foods or supplements that I could take that would counterbalance that. And so I started doing that immediately as soon as I saw what, you know, if I had a day where something was elevated, like let's say strontium was elevated, I'd take that supplement multiple times during that day and again later in the day take my vocal print and have it checked, and it would show that that substance had lowered. So I did that during the period of time while she was really getting the software really to a complete package to give people more of a printout. And it was, I think it made quite a difference, or I would, rather than thinking, I'd say it felt like it made a difference. And it made me feel really, I would say positive. It's not quite right, but I'll use positive in the sense that it gave me a sense of I can take action and do something for myself that's beneficial, which is quite empowering. And really, you know, not unlike the fire situation where Sherry gave me information about information in the fires from all the exposure we had, but I'll talk about that afterwards. So that was my experience with the radiation software.
Well, when we created the radiation software, we do have it up on our website, thesoundhealthoptions.com, and it is totally free for people that you can download it, use it on your and we're trying to serve the public, to give the public tools and solutions. That's what the Institute is about, so that, like Richard said, you can bring about this idea of self-help to your family, well, to yourself and your family, and hopefully to your community. The two-day free classes that we do for people is enough information to allow them to put a bioacoustic center in their own community, and the classes are free, so they only have to buy a microphone. So that's what we're about here at the center. And the other thing that we do is research. We did the research on Parkinson's and turned that around. Macular degeneration. You can read about a lot of this. We just did hives and found the frequencies that will take away hives and the reactions to peanut butter and nuts. So we're doing a research project. If we do an epinephrine sound instead of an EpiPen, which was $750 a pop, if we could do it by sound, we think that would be great for families that really can't afford these pens and have all of these children who have allergies. So that's where we're coming from today. And we really thank all of our audience for helping and giving suggestions, just being here with us and leading us on. And we get a lot of mail from people saying that you're doing good work and please do more. We're going to dedicate this software. It's free. You go online to get yours done. We're going to dedicate it to those in California who lost their loved ones and their property. And I'm hoping Richard will mention more about that. And we're going to put the 9/11 software that we did for the 9/11 catastrophe, because one of the things that Richard brought to my attention with all these houses burning, this electrical toxins in the air, and just we were able to take away the farm and cough. I'm going to look at Richard's voice right after the show because he still has a cough. And remember, it was frequencies, the antibodies for Murex that we were able to look at. So we want to stick a microphone in front of your face, look at your vocal anomalies, and see what's going on. We've been collecting data since the early 80s, and we have found out that everyone who has a similar disease has similar vocal anomalies. We're trying to gather all that and turn it over to the public. Richard, that is my announcement.
Okay, I have a couple of announcements. One will be about the fires. I'll talk about that in a minute, but I thought this was a really great thing. The Oregon governor finally sides with the Hood River County over Nestle. And so what this means is that the Oregon governor, Kate Brown, told the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to withdraw a water exchange application that would have allowed Nestle to build a $50 million plant, water bottling plant, to suck water, those are my words, out of the Columbia River Gorge, and then take that water and stuff it into plastic. And since the water bottling industry bottles about, I think they increased this year bottling up to another 150 billion plastic bottles a year, you can imagine any words I might fill in there of how I feel about all that much plastic. So I think that's really great for a governor of a state to say, no, we're just not going to let you suck water out of our river and take as much as you want endlessly without any, you know. So there's that. So I think that's really good news. And to stop Nestle from sucking more water. They do it in enough states as it is. Then
weren't
the other
they
one,
taking water, weren't they taking water free out of some big reservoir when California was having such a drought, they were still taking water for free?
Yes. Yeah, they pay something like, I'm making up a number, but it's a very low number. I mean, less than $1,000 a year for the rights to draw endlessly out of an area because it was a deal they cut years ago. And they're allowed to draw endlessly out of reserves of water that we don't have. California, even though we had a wet winter, we still don't have enough water here, really. California really is, especially Southern California, is really semi-arid, deserty kind of area. So yeah, they had a deal to draw out water endlessly for a ridiculously small amount of money, let alone it was endless. So yes. So now regarding the fires, I'll start here, and then I'll talk about my own experience a little bit. Currently, this is as of November 1st, the estimated losses from the California wildfires is over $3 billion. Approximately 10,000 residential properties that are partial losses, about 5,000 residential properties that are total losses, over 700 commercial properties. I mean, it's 153 farms and agricultural equipment that are lost. It's mind-boggling in terms of the devastation when you drive up north of where I am and you just see whole developments gone, a couple hundred homes just gone, if I didn't have words for it. And then the work that Sherry's doing that I think is so great with the air quality is because not only do we have the fire retardant, which I'm glad the fires were put out, I'm not saying that. The fire retardant has a bunch of mystery chemicals in it that are not good in terms of inhaling them as vapors. And just about, if I go out my driveway and look up over the hill during the fires, you could see the flames at the crest of the hill on the other side. It didn't get to my side of the hill, but the other side. So it was that close. And we had a giant 747 that had been converted into a fire retardant dump thing, the delivery device that would fly. And I mean, I have no idea how many pounds, because at one point, excuse me, that's part of the cough. At one point, that was flying, during all daylight hours, it would go and reload and come back and dump. So we had that in combination with the part that people don't think about is that all the materials and all those homes and all those buildings that burned, so that means all of the plastic in the wiring, all the insulation, all the woods, all the materials that burned also and vaporized. So that was also in the air. So in the town of Sonoma where I am, which is a small town north of San Francisco by about 40 miles, in this whole area up here, Napa, Sonoma, Santa Rosa had the most devastation in terms of loss of homes. All that got into the air. So everywhere I go, people are croupy and coughy. So I'm very excited to hear about this project. And I have noticed a difference from the vocal prints, again, like the radiation experiment. I did this early on with Sherry, as soon as she put up software and started looking at my vocal prints and started taking supplements. And I noticed a difference in how I feel. I also noticed on her chart that she designed, again, showing supplements for what I was feeling. She was showing indicator muscles, and I was having cramps in particular muscles or areas of my body, and I would take the supplement and those cramps would stop. So it's been really positive. I still am croupy, but I can't imagine what I'd be like if I wasn't using that software and taking the supplements. So I'm really excited that you've decided to put it up on the Sound Health portal. I put that in chat so people can find it. And I will find some local radio stations so we can get that information out there.
Or if any of our people listening know of local radio stations that we could send a public announcement to. And again, this is absolutely free and they'll get a printout. We're just trying to help.
Excuse me while I cough off camera, off mic. Okay, now, are we ready? Are we ready to introduce John?
We're good.
Okay, great. This is going to be a fun show. John David Mann rose to international prominence with The Go-Giver, co-authored with Bob Berg, which has sold more than 500,000 copies in 24 languages and been hailed as one of the most important parables about business and life of our time. The Recipe by John David Mann and Charles Carroll takes you into the world of a 14-year-old Owen Devon, whose life has just been turned upside down by the death of his father. Angry with the world, Owen is spiraling downward until he breaks a warehouse window and must make reparations by working in a local diner under the direction of a singularly unreadable and somewhat mysterious chef. Each new chapter brings new kitchen secrets as Owen learns to prepare, cook, and present secrets that ultimately spell out a recipe for personal greatness. Rule 1. Always be hungry, Owen, the chef said softly. Don't ever let life just wash over you. Savor it. Every smell, every taste, every sound. That's rule 1, Owen. Taste everything. With that, we welcome John David Mann.
Well, thank you so much. What a magnificent 15-minute, prelude. Like, I am still bowled over by your sound prints, Sherry, and all the stuff you guys were talking about. I'm eager to get to Owen and the recipe, but I gotta say I am just stunned and delighted by the work that you're doing. I think it's fabulous.
We'll get together after the show.
Cool. Well, on to Owen and the recipe. Thank you.
Okay, so on to Owen.
Yeah.
For those that have been listening to us for a while, people know that I used to be in the restaurant world. I used to be a chef. Certainly not like this chef, but I did have an experience not dissimilar, not as soft and warm and fuzzy in a certain way, but definitely, it's the culinary world for sure. And my question for you, my starting question for you is more of a you question than about Owen in the book, is how did you journey from writing a musical score at the age of 13 for Prometheus Bound to being the co-author of Bob Berg's Go-Giver, a must-read by anyone who wants to change the world, as stated by Arianna Huffington, and now the great story, The Recipe, and The Sniper. I mean, how did you – this is quite a journey. I mean, this is an amazing journey. When I look at your page of books, which I'll put in chat, it's like, wow, your story is a movie. So how did this – how did you get from being a musician – to being a writer, to being, working with Bob Berg. Let's start there.
And the sniper, mustn't forget the sniper. Yes.
No.
So it is a long and twisted tale. My life is sort of, if you look at my career path, it does look a little bit like the wheel tracks of the lurching wagon train trying to find its way across the continent and not really knowing how to get there. I've kind of gone from thing to thing. I started out as a musician, as you said. My father was a choral conductor and musicologist. Classical music was my heart and my soul and my life. I loved it, still do. I still think in Bach and Bartok, and that's just my brain is wired to classical music. But I became dissatisfied with sitting on a stage playing the cello, looking out and seeing people who looked like they were appreciating the music, but they weren't very healthy and very happy. I wanted to do something that had a greater impact on the world than play music. And that's not to take anything away from playing music, which is, it's a fantastic thing. Someone like Sting or Bono or Beethoven, or people have changed the world with their song, but I wanted to do something different. So I got very involved in the whole wellness, natural foods, nutrition world, and spent over a decade sort of working in that realm in the Northeast. And I published a journal on my first publication. Really, was a journal on health and environment issues. I was writing about the climate change back in the 1980s, when it wasn't a thing, or at least people weren't saying it was a thing. And then from there, I got involved in sort of the world of business. We were saying earlier, network marketing, direct selling, and the world of nutritional supplements and different health products. And got very involved as an entrepreneur and ended up editing for a variety of business and networking journals. And editing sort of merged into ghostwriting, and ghostwriting merged into co-authoring, and co-authoring turned into this career that I seem to be having now, which is writing books. None of this was planned. All of this was done without a net. No animals were hurt in the process of this career path. it's been kind of weird, but here I am. In the course of all that, I went through two marriages that didn't work out, and then found a third that did. So there you go. Third time is a charm, and at the age of 63, I'm deliriously happy with my life, and it's been a strange hunt.
We're not ready for the sniper. We'll get to that. How did Bob Berg appear? Yeah. For people who don't know, Bob the Go-Giver is a great book. I mean, you have a really. I'm only familiar with your writing style from The Go-Giver and The Recipe. And you have a really nice style, very engaging, very – well, we'll get to The Recipe. I mean, The Recipe is really, you know, well-written, and especially for somebody who used to be in that world, you have a great eye for detail. I think you're slightly possessed about cooking, but you have a great eye for detail. So how did Bob Berg show up on your doorstep, or did you approach him, or how did that start? Because that's such an amazing book. I mean, that's been around for a long time. It sold maybe millions of copies by now. I mean, how did that occur?
So I like to say Bob Berg ruined my career. And here's how that happened. I was headed for Hollywood. That was my plan. I was studying screenwriting with a wonderful guy in L.A., Hal Crossman, who's a brilliant screenwriting teacher and has helped launch many careers. I was loving the whole thing. I was reading every screenplay I could get my hands on. I traveled out there a couple times to this admittedly strange place called Hollywood. But I really was enamored with the whole thing of movies and screenplays, and that was my deal, my plan. And Bob, whom I knew because I'd edited a bunch of his stuff, articles of his and a book or two of his. Bob, yeah, it was the deal. So Bob Berg, for those of you who don't know, sort of started out in life as a salesperson and then a trainer and has become kind of a thought leader in the whole world of business and leadership and all that. So Bob tapped me on the shoulder one day through email and said, listen, I got this book I want to write. But I can't write it. It's not what I do. I write how-to stuff about sales and so forth. I want to write this story. I don't do that. I need you to write it. So I need you to write it with me, and then I'll make you a deal. You do the heavy lifting with the writing. I'll do the heavy lifting on promotion. And I said to my fiance, I don't have time for this. Since then, I've come to cherish the words I often hear coming out of my mouth. When things happen, like, you know, my health insurance doesn't go through, or the car isn't working, or there's a problem with the window, or something just isn't going on right, I'll hear myself say, I don't need this right now. And every time I laugh when I hear myself say that, because I hear some Zen monk answering, of course you need it right now. If you didn't, it wouldn't be happening. maybe it's Eckhart Tolle I hear saying it. I don't know. But that's what happened. Bob said, I need you to write this book for me. And so I said to my fiance, well, it's Bob, so I've got to at least give him a hearing. We went and we visited him. We sat for an afternoon. We kind of batted some ideas around. I came back home. I noodled with it. I wrote a scene in the book, which is where Deborah Davenport talks about authenticity. And I kind of played with that. And, you know, Richard, it just kind of jumped to life in front of my eyes. And it was almost like the moment of conception. I felt this thing like stirring and sparkling and saying, write me. And I showed it to Bob and he loved it. We went back and forth, and in 6 weeks we had a manuscript, and which was turned down over 20 times in New York, but finally did get published. And that was the end of my screenwriting career and the beginning of me and books.
Wow. But you use the word, it's interesting because in that, as you talk about it, in there you talk about, you use the term writing a scene. And that's
such a
different way of thinking about writing a book than typical, you know, book writers that, who are writing books. You're thinking visually, you know, you're, like you said, you're writing a scene. In your mind, you're having a dialogue, whether it's a dialogue or not. You're writing, and there's a lot of that same texture for me that's carried over into the recipe because it's really, you know, amazing.
See, that's
bunch of scenes.
Yeah, that's cool that you pointed that out. I hadn't even noticed that I said that, but that's so true. You know, the these are both parables. They're classed as parables, and a parable is simply. You know, it's a simple story, a simplified story that's told to illustrate a point. So you've got parables in the New Testament. You've got parables in every culture. You know, Aesop's fables are parables, but they have animals, so they call them fables. That's what a parable is. And in the business world, parables, you know, in many circles kind of have a bad name. I've had a lot of people say, what is his name, that lovely man? Mark Sanborn, who wrote The Fed Factor. Wrote us an endorsement for one of our GoGiver books, and it's a sweet little sort of left-hand compliment. It basically says, I generally hate parables, but I really like this one. Parables have a bad name in a lot of circles because a lot of people feel like parables can be such like boring, two-dimensional things, and they can be. That's the great danger, that if you write a parable – and it feels like it's sort of a PowerPoint presentation, sort of lightly lay it over with some character names, then it's like boring. Nobody wants to read that. Nobody wants to be lectured to or taught down to. And if a parable feels like it's talking down to you, like it has an idea, but instead of just telling you the idea, it makes up characters called, you know, Jill and Jane and Jack, and they go to the store, it's like, come on, treat me like an adult. For me, the key here is, yeah, you might have some ideas that you want to get across, to teach, to communicate. They can't drive the story. You know, once you're writing a story, what has to drive the story is the life of the people in the story. It has to be real. I mean, if I don't cry while I'm writing it, you're never going to cry while you're reading it. If I'm not surprised, or if I'm not in suspense, or if I'm not suffering when I'm writing this situation, then you know, no reader is going to feel that either. So that I guess that's why I say scene. For me, these little stories are real. They're vignettes of real people's lives, you know, real pain, real suffering, real longing, and real triumph. Triumph's not real unless it hurt to get there to some extent. And the best teaching happens through stories. Everybody really knows this. It's always been true. Well, the best stories communicate through feeling. The aim may be to teach a thought, but the way to arrive at the thought is through feeling. So that's sort of my philosophy of parables. They've got to feel as real as a, you know, 2-hour blockbuster drama on the screen.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we've had storytelling. I mean, before we had anything, I can't quite figure out this timeline, but I don't know if we were drawing on cave walls first, but I have the feeling we were sitting around a fire, throwing a bison leg over our shoulder, and then somebody was telling a story, or you know, as you say, a parable, as an example of, you know, even if in the Wayback Machine, when we were throwing a mastodon bone over our shoulder, we were telling the story of how I didn't get killed today. You know what I mean? But it's a life lesson.
Yes.
It's a delivery system that engages the audience when we're sitting around the fire. And then at some point, somebody stood up and started sketching with a piece of charcoal on the wall and added visual aids to the story. But the story is an amazing delivery system. You know, it's an amazing way to learn and to gather life lesson and have it be contextualized into a living experience, which is so powerful, I think, for people as a delivery system.
I love that we're in the Wayback Machine. I want to know if I'm Sherman and you're Mr. Peabody, or it's the other way around.
So I think we have to – I really want to talk about the sniper, but I think we better talk about No, we have to go to the recipe, because I know if we start talking about the sniper, we'll be run away. So how did the chef approach you? How did Chef Charles? How did this happen? I mean, I know, because we had talked previously, and because I've read enough about you, I know that you have you're possessed about cooking, and I mean that in a good way. You know, and also from the recipe itself, you paint scenes, and your power of observation from everything, from simple things like the towel under the belt. Now, in none of the cooking shows anybody's ever watched, have you ever seen a chef with a towel under his belt? Because somebody off camera is going, that looks horrible, take that out of there. But I am guaranteeing you right now, any kitchen you walk in today, the chef has at least one or two towels in your belt, at your apron belt at all times. Because when you are standing at the stove and you need to grab something hot, you can't go find a pot holder. That's what that towel is for. Or if you cut yourself.
Yes.
So you always have a towel. You always have a towel. Never, ever do you not have a towel. And when you go walk into the dining room to talk to a guest, some waitress is always ripping that towel off of you because you just, you know, it's always ugly. So, I mean, your eye to detail in the recipe is really quite amazing. Everything from talking about, you know, carbon steel knives, which is a little known, you know, piece of information. Or if you're, you know, there's a great line about you can make a mistake, but you can't serve it. I mean, that kind of thing. That's so true. So now, how did Chef Charles appear in your life? I mean, you have somebody in the audience is saying this, and this seems so true, but you're really living in the flow, because here's another, you know, you went from Bob Berg, and you've done a lot of writing. You've written a boatload of books. But, you know, then Chef Charles appears. How does that happen?
Well, you know, the funny thing about that those details that you mentioned, and I'll take a quick digression and then it'll come back to your question. The digression is, you know, there's I am not a trained chef. I am not a professional chef, which actually was an advantage in writing this book. And let me just go back for a moment to The Sniper, which we won't talk about, but I've written a bunch of books with this Navy SEAL sniper. And the beauty of writing those books for me was that I've never served in the military. I don't know anything about guns. I am not a military guy. And I felt that gave me an advantage, because I didn't know any of the terminology. I didn't know anything about Navy SEALs. So I had to ask about it. I had to find out about it. I was at least as ignorant as any of my readers. So I didn't make leaps of assumption which would leave the readers, you know, wondering, wait, what's he talking about? I had to explain it to myself. The same thing was true with Bob Berg. It's like that's, again, that scene in The Go-Giver, and when we talk about Deborah Davenport, she gives this speech where she talks about how she learned every closing method from A to Z, and she goes, oh, you don't believe me? And then she goes through them, and she goes through 26 different closing methods that are all, you know, from A, B, C, D, E, ending up with Zsa Zsa Gabor and the Yahya Sisterhood and whatever. Most of them are real closing methods, and I didn't know any of those. I had to go look that up. I had to go find that out. So that's how it was with the chef. I didn't know about the towel on the waist and about the carbon steel knives and about all these things. It was such a fun sort of expedition to learn about them. To answer your question, it happened just like Bob Berg. Chef Charles approached me. He had read The Go-Giver. Charles is the executive chef of a very she country club in Houston, the River Oaks Country Club. Barbara Bush was there twice last week. I mean, that's just an example of the sort of the upper society, upper crust. And this guy runs a kitchen with 750 employees. I mean, sorry, 75 employees, five kitchens, puts on 80 to 100 banquet events per week. They all under Charles's thumb. He's running this gigantic cooking machine. But he is also, he's like the opposite of that autocratic tyrant chef you see on TV. He's like the Bob Berg of the culinary world. He's this gentle, sweet guy who lives to build up other people, to bring out the strength in other people. So he's like, it's like going to a day camp when you visit his kitchen, or a dojo. He's like this guy who is raising all these young people. It's so cool. So he contacted me and said, I love The Go-Giver. I'm using it in my country club. I'd love to have you come out and give a talk. I went and gave a talk, and he told me he had this idea for a book. And I said, bam, got to write that with you. We got to do that. That was 9 years ago. It took us years to make our schedules work and to sort of find the time for it. But we finally did. And a lot of the stuff that Owen learns in the kitchen, sort of him learning how to peel and how to slice and how to do these things, it's really a record of me in my kitchen. I went back and forth from my desk to my kitchen learning how to do these things, sometimes with Chef Charles on my phone, sometimes just looking at YouTube videos, sometimes just trial and error. So I'm learning along with Owen as I'm writing this book.
Wow, well, you learned well. I mean, as I say, the details in here and the comments that you come up with, is everything. And again, for me, it's a very personal thing, having been in the kitchen for on and off for almost 20 years, that
yeah.
when you talk about things, you know, one of my favorite lines was, this is in reference to the young man, Owen, trying to get a read off of the chef. It was you say that the chef was unreadable as a chopping block. That's so true. I have worked with that guy. Where you can't tell if he's gonna, you know, hug you or knife you, and that's always a fine line. You know, just your, you know, everything that you observe, and I, you know, is really, it's a great parable. I mean, it's a great story because it is so. And he talks about, that's one of the things he talks about, is that, well, that quote that I opened with about where you're using all of your senses. And that's one of the things
yeah.
that people don't know about cooking, is that it's not just, well, A, unlike, I believe you might have referred to, although it's my, these are my words, you might be saying that he's not Gordon Ramsay. That's my opinion. I won't blame that on anybody else. He's not Gordon Ramsay. He's so not Gordon Ramsay. Did I say that enough? It really.
Definitely
go
yes,
ahead.
Not with you, not me. Definitely yes. I did not say that.
Exactly. But it really is an experience of all senses, and people don't.
Yeah.
When we watch cooking shows, which are ridiculous. I mean, I'm not saying I don't watch them, but it's, you know, mostly ridiculous in the sense of, if you're sitting in a room with people who have actually cooked, we're all like throwing things at the screen like, what, are you kidding me? You know, that's so not true. But it is really that
yeah.
thing of all of your senses are involved. There's some time where the chef is giving Owen some lessons about that very thing, where you are, you're hearing, you're smelling. You're watching and you're standing at the pan, but when you're in a real kitchen cooking and you're cooking 5 to 20 things at once, because that's just how it goes, you don't just stand and cook a steak. You cook and stand
right.
20 steaks or something. So you actually don't know that you develop a sense of, you know, when that pan is the right temperature, when you put that steak in, if it's not the right temperature, if you don't hear a particular sound, you pull it out, or you just know when it's ready, or, you know, you develop other senses. And that's such
yeah,
a powerful tool.
Yes. Yeah, it's funny, too, because I've had a lot of readers come back and say, you know, things like, I cried and I was moved and I was touched, and that's excellent. But I've also had people come back and say, you know, I am better in the kitchen. I've got more excitement about cooking. I am, you know, in my kitchen more. I'm more jazzed and more confident about cooking. And that fills me with thrill, because, you know, I want that to happen. Cooking with him is really interesting, too, because, as you say, I'm obsessed with cooking. My wife and I love to cook together. We do it a lot. I am not fancy, but we just love good food. And we've both been involved in natural foods for years, which means we tasted real vegetables for decades. And cooking with Chef Charles is interesting because I expected razzle dazzle. You know, the guy is like a Olympian gold medalist. He's won every award you can think of. He's just, he is a razzle dazzle guy. He does all those fancy things, or he can, with the ice sculptures and the knife, you know, and all the stuff. But what I get when I was with him a couple of weeks ago in Houston, what I get when I'm with him in the kitchen is, it's like a lot of it is just him with his hands. I mean, just, it's almost like watching him play with a baby. It's very tactile. It's very personal. And what really comes across is not his expertise as much as his love and his passion for the food. It's really interesting. It's a very much more sort of gentle, personal, and immediate kind of thing than I expected. I expected to be impressed, which I was, but more than that, it was like, this is like watching a guy make a pot with clay with his hands. And that's the kind of, you know, as you say, all your senses. It's really, it's having a relationship with the food, not being the master with dazzling pyrotechnics, but just really having a relationship with the food and making it into something that's part of you. It's a cool, cool thing to watch.
Well, and I believe that it's at some point it gets a little blurry for me because I had so much experience in that world, but I'm pretty sure in there you talk about, I think it's early on, that he talks about really wanting to bring out, that was it, when he's first showing Owen how to cook a filet, that he really talks about, A, why are you salting and peppering? That's Owen's question, and it's really about bringing out the flavor. But you don't want to overdo it because you really want to honor the product that you're cooking. Those are my words.
Yeah.
But I know that you said it in a different way, but that's really what it's about. It's about bringing out the flavor, the best quality. You get the best quality product, and you honor the quality of that product, and you want to bring out that quality of that product. And that's really, you know, I really like the character of the chef. Because that's so true. It's not about razzle dazzle. I didn't go to culinary school. I didn't learn how to beat, you know, egg whites in a copper bowl like everybody that looks like they do in culinary school. I just worked under somebody who was tough, brutally tough, leaned much more toward Gordon Ramsay than your chef.
Yeah.
But you really, and that's such a great part of the story, is it really is that, because you, as you say, you would think that this guy, and that's what I'm, it's interesting that you're saying that, because I think from reading the book that this guy would be full of razzle dazzle because he has the skill set to be full of razzle dazzle, but yet he's not. He's really about, again, from a personal view, I think of cooking as the ultimate transitory art, because you have an idea in your mind, even if you're not really thinking that as you're doing it, typically. You have a group of things that you're going to put on a plate because you think they all go well together and they complement each other in textures and flavors and tastes and, you know, olfactory sense when you present the plate. And then you present that to a person and they go, oh, wow. And then they suck it down because it's delicious and it's gone. So it's a real interesting, it's not like being an artist with a painting or an artist with something else. It's presented and then it's gone. And people go, oh, wow, that was amazing. What was that? And that's really carried through the book, where that's a lot of what Chef is about, is, no, really, you know, stick with the integrity of what you're presenting. Don't get lost in the, you know, there is no razzle dazzle in the book. And it's really, it's a great story. Go ahead.
Although you have to admit that in that last banquet, there's a little razzle dazzle.
Oh, my goodness, yes. I didn't want to give any spoilers, but yes, there is. Boy, howdy. Wow.
But, you know, the thing you say about the seasoning of the steak, it's kind of an interesting metaphor because, you know, as the chef says, and this is early in the book, you know, Owen asks, why do you salt and pepper it? And he basically is saying, as you said, it's not to add to its flavor, it's to bring out its own natural flavor. So it's, you know, you don't want to over-season it, but you don't want to under-season it. Delivering praise or correction to a person is something like that. I mean, giving someone under your tutelage some praise or some correction or some observation is a lot like seasoning. You can overdo it, and then you just, you know, batter the kid down or unnecessarily overly build the kid up, you know, inflate his ego to a point where you've lost track of what we're actually doing. And to me, that was the most fun in writing the book was I had a handle on who Owen was when the book started, but I really didn't know who the chef was. And watching the way the chef worked with Owen, you know, there are times where he doesn't say anything, and you really think you almost want him to, and he just is hands off. And then there are times where he steps in and says things that catch me by surprise. And to me, that is, you know, whether it's teacher, parent, whatever kind of mentor, the mark of a masterful mentor is that sensitive hand in when to deliver the word of praise or scold or correction or observation, and how to deliver it, and when, probably far more often, not to. That's like, to me, the chef with the food. It's almost like you could have a razzle-dazzle chef, and then when you get the meal on the plate, as you're describing, you have all these things come together in the plate, does the guest say, wow, what an amazing chef must have done this? Or does the guest say, oh, my God, this tastes so good? So that, you know, Chef Charles's goal and the chef in the book's goal is to bring out the beauty of the food, not to impress the guest with the chef. It's just like what, you know, Bob and I say in The Go-Giver, the whole business of if you take your attention off yourself and put it on, you know, imbuing value or being in service to the other, you create much more value in the world and you end up being more elevated yourself. It's like,
well, and I think that part, yeah, and one of the things that you talk about in the book and one of the chef's rules was build your team. And
yeah.
A lot of the performance, and a number of the performance chefs, I'll pick on Mario Batali, not because I think Mario Batali is a brilliant chef and a food monster. In a good way. I mean, he loves good food. He loves a great meal. He loves a family event.
Yes.
But he can be a performer. You know, he does the thing with the olive oil and the thing and the pour, and he's quite a showman. But that's,
yes,
I bet, very
yes.
different when he's in a real kitchen. You know, when he's in a kitchen, he's
yeah.
a get down. You know, I just know that look. I know that I'm
yes.
sort of a similar body type, and I'm fond of Crocs. So there's that. It's a, I don't know. It's a chef thing. It's a lifestyle. Shorts, Crocs, fleece vest. Go, you know, I can cook anywhere this way. But there is that, it's a thing where you're really about the food. You're not about the performance. And I think in real life, he's about the food because I've watched him do a number of events where he's not so performing. Although when he has an audience, he performs. And when you have an audience, part of what you do is a performance because, you know, when you whip out a knife and start, you know, slicing things or dicing or smashing or, you know, it's always like makes the audience go, woo. Well, yeah, it's impressive, but it's because you want to keep all your fingers that it's impressive. You actually need to keep your hands intact so you learn to become skilled with a knife or you don't do it.
Yes.
There is part of it.
Not for long,
Not for long, right. You,
for long.
Oh, Stumpy, Stumpy's around the corner making pastry now. Yeah. But you really, you know, that really is a thing. And talk more about that rule five about build your team, because I think that's a really important part that Chef is really into, is that the importance of that. All those people that are not standing out front going, look at me, I'm the chef. Your crew is making it happen. Like even Anthony Bourdain does a very good job of this, of really acknowledging that I, you know, yes, I was on the line, but, you know, I'm really, it's really the crew behind me that's making this happen. And that's really true.
Yeah, I love that.
The build your team part. Yeah.
You know, in the book, there are, of course, these seven rules. The chef has seven rules of the kitchen, and they appear one by one. At first, you don't know how many there are, so we just gave away that secret. And the seven rules of the kitchen, which are, by the way, based on Chef Charles's 20 rules. He's got, I mean, I made up a lot of them, but he has a little card that his employees really do carry around in their pockets with his rules of the kitchen. So the chef has seven rules of the kitchen, which prove to be seven rules for living, really a recipe for life. And as you say, rule five is build your team. First half of the book is very internal. It's a lot about, you know, Owen's personal experience. But in the second half of the book, it starts to open up more. They cook in bigger spaces. They're going toward this banquet. The book opens up into larger vistas, and the conversation starts being more about other people and the world and your team. And this is interesting. I didn't know this when we started writing, but I learned it as Chef and I were talking. He didn't learn this himself until he went to the Olympics. When he was starting out his first couple years as a chef, he said it was all about personal achievement. You go to the competitions, it's all about trying to beat everybody else, and you'll come out on top. He won his first bronze medal at the age of 19, and it was 5 years later he was on his first Olympic team. Up to that point, these are my words, but basically what he told me was, it was all about me, me, me. he got in the Olympic team. And for listeners who do not know this, which I did not know this until I wrote the book, that there is a culinary Olympics. It happens every 4 years in Germany, and it's just like that other Olympics. It's brutal. It's world-class. You know, you poured in hundreds of hours that are not remunerated in any way to try to compete in the world stage and represent your country and come out with the gold. His first team, age 24, he said when he started working on the Olympic team, it was the first time he realized he had the experience of we all sink or swim together. Instead of hoarding my secrets, he said, I started realizing I needed to give away all my secrets to all my teammates. Because, you know, if you know any of them were a weak link, it took us all down. And it was coming out of the Olympics, he came home with a very changed perspective. And honestly, ever since then, his life has been all about team building. Mine's always been that way because I grew up playing chamber music. And when you're in a string quartet, you know, your goal isn't to beat the viola. It doesn't work that way. There may be some exceptions that people I've known, but Gordon Ramsay does not play the viola. Never mind. The whole dynamic of, again, it's the go-giver mentality of the premise of the go-giver was putting your focus on other people and starting everything you do with a question: How can I make the other person's life better? Is not only a philosophically satisfying and sort of a noble, altruistic way of looking at things, it's also eminently practical. It's pragmatic. It's this thing where if you live your life building other people, the world is going to take care of you in a beautiful way. It's the people who are always looking out for themselves first who end up, having miserable lives and often failing because when they're on fire, who's going to come around to put them out? Bad metaphor probably in the current situation, but hey.
No, I'm okay with that. Really, it is, especially, I'll stick with the non-role model of Gordon Ramsay. Gordon Ramsay kind of sets up situations in one of his shows, Hell's Kitchen, where they compete against each other, but eventually they do have teams, although usually those teams are really meant to get either each other into contention rather than in teamwork. But that's you talk about there is a section in the book where Chef talks about a new style out. Talk about I forget who it is. It might be the breakfast cook, and I forget what's the nickname for the breakfast cook?
Mad Dog.
Mad Dog.
Mad Dog. And then there's Will, the other one. Yeah.
That's it. The afternoon cook. First, I'll put in a note that all breakfast cooks are Mad Dogs. In order to be a breakfast cook, you have to be of a certain driven, possessed. I've been one of the. I did brunch for years, so I mean, there's a certain thing that happens when you cook eggs. When I would go through three cases of eggs on a Sunday morning, that right. You do become a Mad Dog, and I don't know what it is, but it's totally true. But talk about that thing
little bit like Jack Nicholson in The Shining, right? A little bit,
and sometimes a little too much Jack Nicholson. Yes, caffeine and eggs. It can be a bad mix sometimes. But talk about that amazing dance, because you do talk about that amazing dance that occurs in the kitchen with Will, where it seems like they're psychic, where they just sort of flow with each other. And talk about that. I'm certain Chef talked about
it. Yeah. I mean, I tried, you know, my best not to be cliched in that. I think I avoided using the phrase well-oiled machine, but maybe I did that.
Yes. No, you didn't.
These two work together. This is the chef who owns the diner and Will, his right-hand guy, who's the afternoon and dinner cook. And Chef and Will, Owen watches them. And it's almost as if, talk about finishing each other's sentences, they finish each other's movements. They finish each other's, you know, kitchen activities. One has the knife when the other one needs it. One has the spatula when the first one needs it. They work together as if they are one intuitive operation. In total synchrony, and you know what Owen does not know is that Chef and Will have known each other a long time. I won't say more. I've already said too much, but there are surprises in the story, and there is backstory, and there are things that will be revealed as you read through. But it's like that when you have worked with in an environment like, I know you've experienced this, in a kitchen, also true in chamber music. I used to play with my brother, who's also a musician, and even though I was nowhere near the level of skill of pianists that he worked with, when we would play together, it was like I knew exactly when he was going to play what note before he knew what he's going to play it, because we're brothers. There's nothing that can quite replace the substance of time and practice together. When you work with someone that you've known really well, I just listened to you and Sherry. I don't know how long you've done this show together, but just listening to the two of you for the first 15 minutes is a little bit like that. I mean, you guys clearly have the sound of two who have worked together on radio. It's an amazing, magical thing, and it cannot happen solo. It's a dynamic that could never happen by one person, no matter how skilled or pyrotechnic he or she was. That's the beauty and magic of teamwork, I think. And that's something that, I guess in a way that's what it took to finally pull Owen out of his existential funk, which is where the story starts and what the story is really all about, is how do you get past tragedy and loss? And it's when he realizes that he's part of this, he's become part of this team, and he needs to be in this team. He doesn't yet know what that's going to mean, but he finds out. I think that whole thing of build your team, it's sort of the redemptive piece of the story.
Mm-hmm. And the team...
Man, you get me to say all kinds
is,
of things.
That is the... Well, I mean, I was trying not to dive too far back into the restaurant world, but I mean, it is really true that when you work with a crew, and I would say possibly one of the differences between that and the orchestra is when the last restaurant I was in, I would come to work at about 11 in the morning, and I'd leave at about midnight or 1 in the morning. And so when you're with people that long and you serve hundreds of meals a night, anywhere between, 200 and 500 meals, you do become a ballet. Although we're lumbering oafs with too many towels in our belts, you do become a flow. You know exactly when that guy is going to take the steak off the thing and put it on the plate, and you want it to rest for a couple of minutes, not as long as it really should, but you want it to rest for a few moments, and then add the sides to it so the meal can go all out hot at the same time, because it's not... People don't know that in a kitchen, the guy on the broiler station is not the guy who's handling the sides, like the greens or the chard or the garnishes or that. That's another person. But you all have to get it out at the same time so it's hot. Otherwise, that's bad. That's very bad.
Yeah.
That never ends well. So it really is a dance, and it really is. You do know the flow of how everybody – and even if you're working with somebody you may not like because they're – well, any number of things, you still have a flow to how that work goes. So it is an amazing team, teamwork,
yes.
Team building, thing. And I've worked in one of the early kitchens that I worked in. We brought in a lot of people because the boss liked to bring people that had been in jail and give them a chance. And there would always be this awkward sort of, we had a team and then we'd bring in a newbie who, was like, what are we doing? And wasn't used to being in a team. They were used to being a soloist, a survivalist. And that's a very different thing. And you have to get them to like unwind. And then once they're in the flow, it's great. But if they can't get in the flow, it's not happening. I'm stunned to see that we're careening toward the end. But I mean, it's a great read. Your scene building skill is awesome. And it's a great story. I mean, it's a great life lesson. It's a great, it's not a phrase I'm trying to use, but I can't help it. It really does tell a great story that when you get to the end, I almost gave a spoiler. When you get to the end, wow. That's all I'm saying. I'm giving you no giveaways, but I'm just saying, wow. Didn't see that coming. But it's really, it really is about, it's a great pile of life lessons from an extraordinary chef, and you're taking his story, and it's a great story. I'm surprised to say that it's a great story. Not surprised because of you, but I just in the sense of, especially having been in the culinary world, I mean, the culinary world is grueling. I lean more toward the Anthony Bourdain Kitchen Confidentials restaurant world. So to see this other side where you really do talk about the team and the caring and the family that is built out of being in a restaurant for a period of time. I mean, it's quite moving in a positive way. It was a great experience.
I want to see the cooking show I want to see on Food Network is I want to see Bobby Flay cleaning up. Why don't they ever show us this? This is the real world. Cleaning. You got to clean.
Yeah.
You got to clean after you do this
thing. Oh, boy. People have no idea what it looks back there after you get through cooking. It is amazing. It's just amazing. Yeah, you need a crew in hazmat suits.
I am amazed. I'm amazed that you've spent an hour and had so much fun and didn't hardly spoil the book at all. But it's made the audience want to know what the parable is, and they're just going to have to go buy it at Amazon or whatever. And another one of the comments that I feel deeply, John David, you feel so down to earth, but it's very obvious that you listen to the fairies with great familiarity. It's just a blessing to see how you've integrated your flow into humanity and made it work. And that's the next book. How did you do that?
Excellent. Well, thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. And I'm taking notes.
It's been a great show.
That was really awesome. So where can people find out more about you and follow your work? And we didn't even get to talk about the sniper. I'm telling you, people, the sniper. That's all I'm saying. Go find out about it. It'll blow your mind. Wow. So where do people find you for the listening audience, the ones not in chat, where do they find your scoop?
All right. It's easy. It is, everything is at my website, which is my name, johndavidmann2ns.com. And all my books are there. My blog is there, which is sort of where I practice writing in front of people. And that's where I am, johndavidmann.com. On the book, when you see the cover of the book, the key to the meaning of the story is in the blueberry pancake recipe on the front cover. And that, I want you to know, is my wife's blueberry pancake recipe. I've been eating it for years. It's delicious. And you'll find the recipe in the back of the book.
I got to go make blueberry pancakes. I can't talk anymore. Now you've made me ridiculously hungry. That was really great. I knew it was going to be a fun conversation, and that was really stupendous. And I am – Sherry's right. I am impressed with both of us that we didn't give away the story because it would be so easy. Oh, boy, just fall right over that edge.
yeah.
Thank you so much, John David. That was great.
And an
complete
awesome
and total
story.
Pleasure.
An awesome
thank you, Sherry.
Story. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right, everybody. I believe on Tuesday, I'm stunned to find that I actually know this. On Tuesday, we're talking to Stephen Huer, so that's always an interesting conversation. And have a great rest of the weekend, and we'll see you on Tuesday. Bye-bye.